May it please the court. This is an appeal from a $100,000 judgment awarding penalties to the state of Texas for in excess of 100 violations of an injunction rendered pursuant to the Deceptive Trade Practices Act for the illegal selling of an unsafe and unapproved drug by the defendant. This case is pursuant to the enhanced penalty section of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, which provides for penalties of up to $10,000 per defendant when the defendant violates not the DTPA itself, but an injunction entered pursuant to the DTPA. There are three problems in the case before the court today. First is that the full record in this case has not been perfected. Second, and most important, is that the standard of review used by the Court of Appeals was either at times the incorrect standard, or when the correct standard was applied, it was misapplied. Third, and relating directly to the second problem of the standard of review, the Court of Appeals, sua sponte, reinterpreted and the state feels misinterpreted the injunction entered by the trial court. All of these errors require reversal. Since all of the points of error are, in the state's opinion, properly read as no evidence points, this court can and should reverse the Court of Appeals and render judgment affirming the trial court. The first point is the unperfected record. The trial court, at the hearing on penalties, after the permanent injunction was entered, assessing penalties, attorney's fees, and putting into place a permanent injunction against the defendants, the trial court, prior to taking evidence, took judicial notice of the entire record of the case, which included the testimony before the court, the same judge, from a two-week jury trial. That record was not before the Court of Appeals and is not before this court. For that reason alone, the Court of Appeals should have affirmed the trial court's judgment and did not, and on that basis alone, this court can reverse the Court of Appeals. But I don't think we need to spend more time on that unless the court desires. What I would like to get into is the problem of the standard of review applied by the Court of Appeals.
Let me ask you a question first.
Yes, sir.
Is the doctor still in bankruptcy?
Your Honor, to the best of my knowledge, he is in bankruptcy. I understand, and perhaps counsel for the doctor can clarify, that the United States government is moving to have the bankruptcy dismissed for bad faith filing, but right now I believe it is pending.
Has the stay order been lifted?
As to this proceeding, no, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, I could not find addressed in the brief anything with respect to the exceptions to the automatic stay order under Section 362 of the Bankruptcy Code. Is it your position that the automatic stay order does not apply to this court?
In this proceeding, yes, Your Honor. I believe, although certainly that has not been brought up to date, I did notify this court, I believe, that the bankruptcy proceeding had been filed a couple of months ago.
But there are certain very, very limited exceptions. For instance, the exception B under Section 362, and you've submitted nothing to us that says that we would fall within an exception to that. Is it your intent to submit anything in writing to us that says that we are free to proceed?
If the court desires, I would be pleased to, Your Honor. I can tell the court, and I'm working from memory, I believe it is 362A4 and perhaps A5 that provides that the automatic stay does not operate as a stay of a police or governmental proceeding by the state. There is authority, reported authority, that exception to the automatic stay applies specifically to consumer protection laws. There are several unreported decisions in Texas where the court has held that the stay did not apply to proceedings brought by the state of Texas.
Well, your close is 362B4.
B4.
Would you submit a post-submission brief within 7 days?
I will be pleased to, Your Honor. I can also advise the court that, if it helps, we also advised the Court of Appeals after it reversed on the other appeal of this case, and I believe after this court had refused to grant our application for writ of error, the Court of Appeals there did stay its proceeding until the Dr. Bashinsky and the others went in and obtained relief from the court, the bankruptcy court in Houston. That was a different situation. It was not the state proceeding with an enforcement action there. It was, in fact, just the opposite. It was preventing the state from proceeding. So we don't think that applies, but the court there did lift it. We think the court, this court does have the right to proceed. Given that, we would be pleased to brief it. The brief on appeal by Dr. Bashinsky says either as to some point facts that are presented for review that there is no evidence, or in other cases that there is no evidence and that it is contrary to the only evidence presented. The Court of Appeals evidently read the latter part of that phrase as a great weight and preponderance of the evidence point. The state respectfully submits that the Court of Appeals was incorrect in that regard. It's beyond question, the Poole v. Ford Motor case being, I suspect, the most recent to hold this, that a Court of Appeals should consider what the appellant is trying to say in the brief, not reading just the points and reading the language of the brief itself. But what I just read to the court was taken right out of the brief. Here I think the Court of Appeals instead basically did the appellant's job for him and has in effect substituted its belief as to how he should have perfected his appeal on his points of error for how in fact the appellant did in fact bring the points of error up. I think simple logic and grammar will show to this court that if a finding is indeed contrary to the only evidence presented, that must mean, by logic and as a matter of interpreting what the grammar of the phrase is, that there is no evidence in support. And therefore, the Court of Appeals did err in deciding that that allowed it to review some of the points on a great weight basis. I will emphasize that the briefs filed by the state below only as addressed no error point, no evidence points. We, if that was what they were intending to say, we certainly didn't read it that way. We only addressed no evidence. We did not, in the alternative, address insufficiency points. When we read it, we were on notice that it was a no evidence point. I think that the reason we were on that notice is because that is indeed what it was. The third point is the fact that the Court of Appeals misread the injunction. I will go into that in more detail in discussing the problems with the specific areas of the injunction and of the trial court's order where I believe the Court of Appeals erred in applying the standard of review. There were five areas, in essence, of fact findings which were reviewed by the Court of Appeals. First, the provision of the injunction which prohibited Bashinsky from representing that dinitrophenol, which is a chemical at issue and which I'll sometimes just call DNP because it's a lot easier to pronounce, that representing DNP as safe. Second, the finding by the court that Dr. Bashinsky was the employer of a telemarketer, self-described telemarketer, who had made many of the representations in a telephone call to the state's undercover investigator. Third, the findings of fact with regard to the injunctive provision, finding that the defendants failed to disclose to patients or prospective patients that DNP was not generally recognized as safe, that dinitrophenol was highly toxic, and that it was a herbicide. Fourth, the finding that the corporate defendant, the clinic, was Dr. Bashinsky's alter ego. And fifth, the finding of fact regarding the injunction provision for soliciting patients or prospective patients with the intent to sell dinitrophenol to them. First, as to the failure to disclose the safety. The Court of Appeals conceded that as to this point and as to the facts necessary to support the trial court's findings and order, there was more than no evidence for as many as seven violations. And the state would say that there alone, that's where this court should stop. There was no evidence. There was more than no evidence. This is a no evidence point, and we have sustained our burden on appeal. Instead, the Court of Appeals went ahead and applied the great weight standard. There are problems in its application. First, it did not, in any, basically in all 3 points I have to raise, it did not follow Poole versus Ford Motor. First, it did not follow Poole by detailing how the facts were indeed contrary to the evidence. Second, it did not follow Poole by showing where there was bias or prejudice, something to shock the conscience, or how the findings were manifestly unjust, all those set forth in Poole as a prerequisite for a finding that a fact is, a finding by the Court of Appeals that a fact is against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence. The only thing that the court did in that respect was note one exchange at the trial and state its opinion that that exchange cast doubt upon the fairness of the proceedings. We responded to that. I can get into that if the court desires. We don't believe that cast doubt upon the fairness as a review of the full record would show, but that in any event does not meet the full standards of showing bias, a shock to the conscience, or how a finding is not only against the great weight but is manifestly unjust. Second, the finding that Dr. Bashinsky was the employer of the telemarketer who testified at trial. Here again, the Court of Appeals only applied the great weight standard. It did concede that there was more than a scintilla, that there was more than no evidence on this point, and this court should reverse on that concession alone. But the Court of Appeals went ahead to apply the great weight standard and, again, did not meet the criteria set forth in Poole. It never gave either direct evidence or inferential evidence to show what great weight and preponderance of evidence exists. The only thing that the court, in its opinion, sets forth the testimony, the Q&A verbatim at length. No question about that. But that's nothing more than an addition or an easier way of referring to the statement of facts. It does not discuss the Q&A. It does not discuss the testimony and does not give this court the bases for its reasoning in concluding that the testimony was against the great weight of the evidence. The only point there was the court said, well, she could not have been his employer because she testified and Dr. Bashinsky testified that she was an employee of the clinic. The state would submit in this case that the telemarketer can indeed serve two masters. There are a lot of people who are employed jointly. There are people who hold down two jobs, and the mere fact that a person is an employee of one entity does not defeat the finding by the trial court that she was indeed the employee of Dr. Bashinsky. Furthermore, again, as with the other great weight review point, the Court of Appeals did not detail to any extent how this finding demonstrated something to shock the conscience, something that was unjust, or something that showed any type of bias or prejudice. As to some of the points, the Court of Appeals did indeed apply no evidence point. The first one I would like to discuss with the court is the failure to disclose language of the injunction. And as I said previously, the problem here is that the court has in essence substituted itself, the Court of Appeals has substituted itself for the trial court and really the appellants and the appellees here by rewriting the injunction. The injunction provision at issue prohibited the defendants or their employees in compliance with, I believe it's Rule 683, from failing to advise patients or prospective patients that DNP is not generally recognized as safe in the treatment of obesity, that it is a highly toxic substance, that it is not approved by the Food and Drug Administration, and that it is a herbicide. We did not sue on the failure to advise on FDA because the one undercover shop we did indicated that she was indeed telling that. The Dr. Bashinsky raised primarily an overbreadth argument in his brief at the Court of Appeals. There were some tinges of vagueness, but it was primarily an overbreadth argument, and the Court of Appeals properly refused to review that and denied that point of error, stating that that should be raised not in a proceeding for penalties for violating the injunction, but in the main case. I believe the Court of Appeals was quite right there, and I will also remind the Court that in the main appeal of this case, the overbreadth and vagueness arguments were never raised. They were only raised in an attempt to avoid the penalties for violating the injunction. The Court of Appeals correctly refused to review the overbreadth, review the minor vagueness complaints, but then, on its own, decided, in essence, to rewrite the language of the injunction to allow disclosure of these negative facts, the drawbacks to this chemical, to allow disclosure, in essence, at the pleasure of the defendants, whenever they saw fit to give it to people. Up until the time of the Court of Appeals opinion, no one had complained that the injunction didn't mean what it said, but only that it was a little overbroad, as the Dr. Bushinsky had said. In fact, Dr. Bushinsky, at the hearing on this case, testified that he had read and understood the injunction. The state proceeded under the broad interpretation, and most importantly, so did the trial court. The trial court that ruled on this case did sit in the jury trial and wrote the injunction that he later enforced. He found that it had been violated, and the Court of Appeals is now saying, well, it doesn't mean that. It means something else. We'll tell you what it means, and leaving us, in essence, in the lurch. We tried it on a different theory.
Your position was that everyone who came in contact with the potential patient had to just make the same disclosure. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. There are other ways of dealing with that, and you can see there are perhaps ways that would have been easier on the defendants, less onerous, that would probably have achieved the same results, but we feel that that is what the injunction says by plain language. Plain reading, it is not overbroad, not properly challenged here anyway, and you read that, and it will, if you read that interpretation, which is what it says, then they have violated the injunction, no question about it.
And the other position that was taken is that you could give them the warning at any time.
Yes, Your Honor, I can address that. We think that there is, in fact, evidence in the record to demonstrate, if you read it the way the Court of Appeals read it, that there that it was violated as well.
Aren't both of those somewhat unworkable? Wouldn't it be easier to give the notice when you first deal with them?
Your Honor, it would. And that's the one I have in mind, is saying there's a better way that probably protects us as much. There's a case now pending before this court, State of Texas versus Mother and Unborn Baby Care. The injunction in that case did specifically that. It required contact at the first time. And in fact, we have a temporary injunction on our retrial of this case on the merits that it's reworded from this, but it does that as well. It requires at the time of the first contact.
That would appear to be the most practical.
It probably is, Your Honor. That does not mean that the reading of the injunction is not enforceable. That does not mean that they could not have had it reviewed in the main case had they thought to do so.
I understand.
But it is, when we drafted the second injunction in the mother and unborn baby care case, we decided that that was a better way to do it. I will concede, I can't concede that this is an unenforceable way. It's not impossible to comply with the reading the state would give. It makes it hard on the defendants, but it's necessary to make sure the word gets out. If you require more than even one at the initial contact, what you ensure is a fail-safe. You ensure that people don't forget. The jury found that this was an unsafe chemical. And the concern was that not only prospective purchasers, but also people who had a supply, there was a lot of publicity about this case, and people who had a supply of this chemical and who contacted the defendants find out that what they had was a poison that was highly toxic, was not FDA approved, and that it was not generally recognized as safe, that they be told that. Making the defendants tell that more than once is going to better serve that than telling the defendants, well, you have to tell them eventually. By that interpretation, they could tell them when the bill goes out for the treatment. They could tell them at any time. They could tell them after people have been taking what is a poison for a number of months, a number of years. That interpretation, I think, is unenforceable as well, and will result in the in essence, a bait and switch, if you allow them to tell it at any time. The information has to be given at a time when it is going to be meaningful to the person.
Dr. Fashinsky raised a point in the Court of Appeals that the Court of Appeals deemed unnecessary to address because they're holding on other points. Chief Justice Phillips will remember the style of this U.S. Supreme Court case. It escapes me for a moment. But it has to do with the mandating of speech being an effective infringement upon the right of free speech.
Right.
What is it?
Somebody versus Riley.
All right.
The Riley case.
All right. Why don't we have that problem here? They're telling this woman in item 7 of the injunction what she has to say when she answers the phone. What, is there an exception to free speech here? Is free speech not applicable?
The courts have held this not being a point. I've not researched it for this court, and I cannot tell the court if this court has ruled on it. I think it has, that First Amendment protections do not extend fully to commercial speech. This is pure and simple commercial speech. The evidence showed that Dr. Fashinsky made millions and millions of dollars off of selling this chemical to his patients, thousands and thousands of patients. That the restrictions are simply not applicable. It's not the marketplace of ideas. It's just the marketplace. People should be free to, sellers should be free to express their opinions. They are not free to deceive. This injunction was entered pursuant to 1746B, this time, 23 of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, which provides that it is a deceptive trade practice to fail to disclose material information. And Justice Kilgarland, I think that the legislature certainly considered that failure to disclose is a deceptive act. The courts have uniformly held that deception in commercial speech is not entitled to First Amendment protection. There is no right to lie to one's customers. And therefore, I don't believe there is a problem. I think the Court of Appeals was quite correct in not reviewing that aspect of it.
It's failure to tell the full truth lying, because that's what we really have involved here.
In my opinion, at any rate, Your Honor, yes, it is. There is truth to commercial purchasers, to consumers. If they don't have the truth, if they don't have the information necessary to make a knowing decision about purchasing any product, they're not going to make a correct one. They are going to cost competitors business. They're going, in this case, they're going perhaps to be unknowingly taking poison. But I do believe that they're in the consumer protection area, there should be black and white. If it isn't true, then it's a falsity.
If you quote the full subparagraph 1746B, subsection 23, it gives you your answer. Failure to disclose information which, had the consumer known it at the time, would have resulted in different action on his part.
Yes, Your Honor. And consumers did at trial testify that had they known of these very drawbacks, they would not have paid hundreds of dollars to purchase this chemical, had they known of the side effects that were going to be occasioned on them. But even assuming that the Court of Appeals' opinion in reading this injunction is correct, and that someone at any point needs to give the warnings, the testimony at the hearing showed, I believe, that no one did give the warnings, at least during the first 5 weeks the injunction was in effect. Dr. Fashinsky testified that no one distributed the injunction to the employees and staff of any of the clinics for the first 5 weeks, approximately, that the injunction was in effect. It was signed on April 10th. It was not distributed until May 15th. If no one received the injunction, I think it is a very fair inference that no one knew what disclosures had to be made and that therefore note the disclosures were not made. We know from the telemarketer's testimony that she didn't know about the required disclosures. Had she known about them, had she known about the injunction, she would have given the disclosures. In any event, the last point on that provision, this does show why the Court of Appeals should have, and we would urge this court, if the court wishes to affirm the Court of Appeals, remand this entire matter for trial on the merits. We did not try this pursuant to that theory. No one did, and we are entitled, if that is how the injunction is to read, where you should be allowed in the interest of justice to try it on that basis. Very briefly, the fourth point is the alter ego point. The Court of Appeals reviewed that on a no evidence standard, and the problem here is the unperfected record. There are facts in the record the state asserts sufficient to establish that alter ego existed. You have to look back in time. Anytime you're reviewing alter ego, it requires a lot of inferences, and sufficient to establish that it still existed at the time of this hearing before this court. In any event, there is inferential evidence in the record pointed out in our brief that would show this court and it would allow the trial court to decide that the clinic, the corporate defendant, was the alter ego of Dr. Bashinsky. The last point is as to soliciting. The court held, in essence, here again, the court had substituted fully its conclusion from the facts before the trial court for the conclusions drawn by the trial court. Here, the trial court drew inferences from the testimony of a hostile, very adversary witness. The only real question is whether there were solicitations and whether there were prospective patients. The telemarketer testified that 50 to 60 callers wanted dinitrophenol because the product was working for them. A fair inference was that these were patients of Dr. Bashinsky because he said he was the only one using this chemical. That, taken together with her avowed intent to protect dinitrophenol, to preserve its future market and its future ability of the clinic and Dr. Bashinsky to market it, supplies more than enough evidence in the record to sustain the trial court. In summary, I believe that this case shows why Court of Appeals review of fact findings will always be a problem for this court. Here, the Court of Appeals failed to apply the correct standard and repeatedly, in addition, put itself, even when it was applying the correct standard, in the position of second-guessing the trial court, the trier of fact that had the live witnesses there, had the people before it that would enable the trial court, in this case it was a judge sitting without a jury, to evaluate fully the testimony and to find the facts and enter a judgment pursuant to that. The trial court did so. It was error of the Court of Appeals to reverse it, and we therefore ask that this court affirm the trial court by rendering judgment for the state in this matter. Thank you, Your Honor.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is now ready to hear argument from respondents.
May please report, Mr. Tom Newman will present argument for respondents.
May it please the court. I'm here to represent Dr. Nicholas Bashinsky and the Physicians Clinic of Dallas, who are the only parties of record in this case. It should be initially pointed out that this is an appeal of the enforcement proceeding only. The state filed separate applications to this court for appeals of the enforcement proceeding as well as the injunction proceeding, then moved to consolidate those appeals, and we opposed that motion. This court has never entered an order to consolidate those appeals, and then additionally, this court has already denied a writ in the injunction proceeding. It was our burden to file the record in this case, and Rule 50D requires us to see that a sufficient record is presented to show error requiring reversal. We contend that we've done that and that the state had an opportunity under Rule 53A to amend that record or to supplement it upon request in the Court of Appeals, and they failed to make that request. They failed to supplement the record. Therefore, the only record before this court is the record from the enforcement proceeding. Because of that, the state's assertions that there are other parties, other clinics, other than Dr. Bashinsky and Physicians Clinic of Dallas, is unfounded, as are their statement of the facts in this case in the first three pages of their brief. I think that we should commence with the case under consideration being that there's an undisputed state contention by the state that the trial court entered a judgment enjoining these two defendants from using DNP and requiring affirmative disclosures of that drug.
Can I ask you, sir?
Yes, sir.
Do you have a position with respect to the automatic stay order issued by the bankruptcy court regarding your client, the doctor?
Your Honor, I am not really well informed on that point. In fact, I was not aware until you asked the question that the state had advised the court that a bankruptcy had been filed. I've not personally dealt with Dr. Bashinsky or other clients in this matter since about August, and apparently that's something that's happened since then. I did discuss it with Mr. Gardner a day or two ago, and I have heard that that's happened. I'm just not familiar with.
Do you wish to respond? You would have 7 days to respond to his brief.
Yes, sir. I think that needs to be touched upon, and I'll be happy to inform the court of what the situation is as soon as I can determine that.
Go ahead, sir.
Well, we also agree that on August 1st of 86, that in a non-jury proceeding, this judgment for civil penalties for violation assessing maximum penalties was entered by the court. We asked the court in reviewing this matter to consider only those facts in trying to determine whether or not the Court of Appeals has applied the correct standard of review on both of these no evidence and the insufficient evidence points. Most of the points that Mr. Gardner has raised in his argument we are prepared to touch upon, but to be sure that I don't overlook some of the points that were brought out by the court's questions, because they were raised in the Court of Appeals and they have not been raised in this court in our brief other than by referring to our brief in the Court of Appeals. The question regarding whether or not this injunction amounts to infringement upon the rights of free speech is covered in pages 20 to 21 of our brief in the Court of Appeals. The specific case, the Texas case, which we raised was Villalobos versus Hawkwood, also the Lancaster case and Ex parte McDonald, as to whether or not this order was void and therefore unenforceable because of its lack of specificity as to terms. In the Villalobos case, the rule of law that was announced by this court in 1948 is that such an order must inform a defendant of the acts he is restrained from doing without calling on him for inferences or conclusions about which persons might well differ. And I think that the ambiguity in this injunction causes it to fall within that category. On the free speech question, the Fifth Circuit Court in Universal Amusement versus Vance warned that when injunctions are drawn too broadly and abridge the conduct protected by the First Amendment, they are constitutionally impermissible. We contend that when you enjoin a person, as was done here, from expressing an opinion as to whether DNP is safe, then you are enjoining their free speech rights. There's also two Supreme Court cases, Organization for a Better Austin versus Keefe, 1971 case, and United Transport Union versus State Bar, a 1971 case that touch upon that point from the federal level. The question was asked whether or not a person has a right to lie as an infringement upon free speech. We contend that while that would not extend that far, it's certain, and to not tell the whole truth, it shouldn't be so construed as to prohibit a person from being able to express any personal opinion, which is what the record shows Jerry Levine did in this case. Before touching upon the questions of standard of review, I'd also like to bring to the court's attention two points that I feel bear upon all six points raised by the state. One is the question of judicial notice, and the other is the fact that this court has already determined by its denial of the writ the correctness of the Court of Appeals ruling in the enforcement hearing. The judicial notice is covered by Rule 201 of the Rules of Civil Procedure, and it provides that the court may take such action upon upon adjudicated facts. But it also tells us what type of facts can be noted. And the limitation is that only those facts which are not subject to reasonable dispute can be noted, can be judicially noted. Now, we contend that the evidence from the prior proceeding, which the state continues to try to have considered, is subject to reasonable dispute, such as that is not covered by judicial notice. Reasons for that is that at the time this suit for civil penalties had been filed, an appeal of those facts had already been lodged. So there certainly was reasonable dispute there. Secondly, we raised that point, incidentally, in the Court of Appeals in our motion, reply to the motion to rehear, and in our response to the application for writ here. Secondly, the Court of Appeals has already reversed those facts. And thirdly, this court has already approved that action. So I think it's fair to say that those facts are at least subject to reasonable dispute and therefore cannot be judicially noticed. Now, the second point is the effect of the denial of a writ in that case by this court. We raised the point in the court below that the injunction was void and unenforceable. That was not touched on by the Court of Appeals. But we contend that it was contrary to this court's holding in the Villalobos case, the Lancaster case, and the McDonald case. The Court of Appeals cites ex parte Fernandez as authority for that not being a void order. And assuming for the sake of argument here that Fernandez is correct law, even though that is a no-read history, and assuming that the Court of Appeals is correct and that that case overruled the three prior decisions of this court, the court itself, the Court of Appeals itself, notes in its own opinion in this case that it is already overruled that proceeding. Consequently, we contend that the prior denial of that writ in the injunction case could well amount to a res judicata on that issue in this case, in this proceeding. Now, with respect to the points raised by the state, there are basically four series of points that we would like to group into two categories. The no evidence and the insufficient evidence points, and then the point that deals with whether or not the case should be remanded on the question of penalties, and on that point we've urged cross points. Basically what the state is asserting is that the holding of no evidence to support the trial court findings on whether or not DNP was safe, FDA approved, and was a herbicide, and whether or not it was advertised or solicited by the defendants, and whether or not Bashinsky was Levine's employer, and whether or not Physician's Clinic was the alter ego of Dr. Bashinsky. All of these points are factual points. The question before this court with regard to those points is whether or not the Court of Appeals applied the correct standard of law. Now, the court has repeatedly held that it has no jurisdiction to review questions of factual sufficiency other than to determine whether the correct test has been applied. In Dyson and Hurlburt, and in Poole, this court did state that on insufficient points, if they really amount to a no evidence point, then this court can consider them. But it went on to say that with the liberal construction policy followed by this court on briefing rules, that the court would look to the intent of the parties, not just to the wording of a point, to determine whether it was a no evidence point or an insufficient point. What we contend is that when we stated in our points of error and in our brief that there was either no evidence or that a particular finding was either supported by no evidence or was contrary to the only evidence offered, then we are raising both a no evidence and an insufficient evidence point. The test is whether or not the Court of Appeals has reviewed all the evidence and set forth in detail the reasons why it's insufficient. The Poole test. The no evidence test announced in Hurlburt and Larson v. Cook is that the appellate court must look only at that evidence which supports the judgment and the inferences which would support the judgment and disregard everything else. Now, we feel that both tests have been applied by the Court of Appeals in this case. Mr. Gardner asserts that evidence, a recitation of the evidence is not a detailing of the evidence such as Poole requires, that the evidence must be discussed. I think that a reading of the opinion will show that the Court of Appeals spent 43 pages trying to live up to the standards set forth by the Poole case and explained exactly why this evidence was factually insufficient and why there was no evidence on these points. We've continued to allege throughout our brief here and in the Court of Appeals and in our argument there that both standards should be applied and then that the judgment was erroneous for both reasons. Now, an example of how that same point has been brought up, in other words, that one language of one point can raise both issues, was mentioned by this court in the Cropper case, recently decided, when it cited in that opinion Houston versus TC Railway Company, which is an old 1884 Texas Supreme Court case. It further went on to point out Chief Justice Calvert's article in the Texas Law Review, which states in effect that a court of appeals should analyze the evidence on both sides of the issue and point out why that finding is regarded as being contrary to the great weight and preponderance of the evidence. Now, what we're saying is that what Judge Calvert said there is just another way of saying what we say. That contrary to the only evidence offered is just another way of saying contrary to the great weight and preponderance of evidence. And we raised that point, and we feel that under this court's rulings in Hurlburt and Dyson and Hebert and Poole, the test applied by the Court of Appeals was proper under both no evidence and under insufficient evidence. But the state goes on to say that the Court of Appeals should have inferred these sufficient facts to support its the findings by the trial court. Well, there's some discussion in the Court of Appeals' opinion about that as to why that could not be done. But the argument there overlooks the fact that the law that says in a Court of Appeals, the reviewing court is required to assume facts that the trial court, to assume that the findings of the trial court were supported by evidence. But that's the Guthrie versus National Homes case. But what that case says and what that case involved was a review of a case where there was no statement of facts. And the appellate court could not hold that the reviewing court did not have the correct evidence before it when it had no statement of facts. In this case, we have a statement of facts. In fact, the state contends that we should have two statements of facts. But clearly that's inapplicable in this case. We feel that the Court of Appeals has applied the correct test and that those facts, factual determination should not be reweighed by this court because no incorrect rules of law have applied and applied. As was pointed out in the evidence, in the testimony at the important hearing, which we're considering here, the state has not ever identified any single patient or prospective patient that was not given the necessary warnings. The trial court just simply found, based on one phone call, that had happened. With regard to the alter ego point, the fact is that there's just no evidence on that point. The Court of Appeals pointed out that neither the trial judge found at the injunction proceeding, nor was the jury even asked whether or not alter ego was present. And so there was no finding at the injunction proceeding. So it would seem improper for the trial court to then find by judicial notice that alter ego exists on the evidence that was presented at the enforcement proceeding. There was just no evidence there, and we feel that the Court of Appeals properly found on that point. Under their sixth point, the state is complaining that the Court of Appeals violations found by the trial court should be remanded so that they can retry this case on another theory of law. We contend that the Court of Appeals correctly applied both no evidence and insufficient standards on their evidence, and that should be sustained. They determined that there was no evidence of any 50 violations, and that there's only a scintilla of evidence of one violation under paragraph 6. They remanded on that point, and we have found a cross point suggesting that there is no evidence on that one point. The reason being that it's undisputed from the record that Jerry Lafine, the person who received this telephone call in question, never had any actual notice of this injunction before the conduct that was complained of occurred. Now, Rule 683 requires that persons who receive actual notice are bound by an injunction.
Whose duty is it to notify the employees and agents of the injunction?
Well, the rule says that it's the duty of the attorneys. And the situation in this case was that the state has had the same attorney all the way through. The clinics and Dr. Brzezinski had one set of attorneys trying this case and another set of attorneys handling the appeal.
Is not the knowledge of the attorney imputed to the others?
Yes, sir. And the testimony shows from the enforcement hearing that there was confusion among the attorneys as to how this injunction should be worded, and that at one point the injunction was sent to Dr. Brzezinski in Houston, and before he could act upon it, the attorney called him up and said, no, disregard that, we're going to enter another one. So they went from like the middle of March to the 10th of April before they ever agreed on the wording of an injunction.
But there was 5 weeks after the 10th of April when the employees were still not notified.
Well, the employees were not, the employees were notified, but they were not furnished a copy of a specific injunction. They just in general terms were told, don't have anything to do with DNP. Get rid of all of it. Get rid of the literature. Don't prescribe it. We're not using that anymore unless the trial court is overturned and we have that right. But in the meantime, this phone call, this undercover phone call is made to the clinic on May the 7th. But Levine didn't ever see the injunction until May the 19th. And I think that it's pointed out that everybody is in agreement that she would have obeyed the injunction had she known specifically what it said. But we contend that she never received any notice, actual notice, of what it said, and therefore she should not be bound by it when she received this unsolicited telephone call from the undercover agent. I want to, in conclusion, make mention of something that I've noticed in reading the opinions of this court preparing for this argument here today, which we contend that the Court of Appeals is correct, except on that point, on that one point that was remanded. We feel that that's a no evidence point, and that this court should reverse the Court of Appeals and enter judgment for the defendants on that point. But it's been suggested in various legal circles about the state and state bar seminars that I've attended that the present state of the law concerning standards of appellate review is somewhat confusing. And several of the dissenting opinions that I've read have suggested that a change be made. The suggestion of change is that we abandon the attempts of the court to reconcile the rights of trial, the constitutional rights of trial by jury, and the constitutional powers of the courts of appeal to review facts. I might suggest that this would be an appropriate case if the court is going to make that change to consider it, primarily because this is a non-jury case. And the
you don't think Cropper versus Caterpillar and Herbert versus Herbert laid the rest at that point?
It laid to rest the majority opinion, but I believe there's still confusion.
What you say, you agree with the dissent.
I was found it quite informative, and I believe that this would be something that the court might want to consider.
What, just amending the Constitution on our own?
No, just interpreting the Constitution.
I don't want to take the position that I would suggest how the court handled it. It just occurred to me that this would be a case that might fall within the suggested category of change if the court saw fit to make those changes. But my primary concern is that the courts consider that the appellate court in this case has applied the correct rules of law, and that the points of error are broad enough to cover both insufficiency and no evidence points, and that with one exception I mentioned, the Court of Appeals opinion should be affirmed.
Thank you.
I think the first thing I need to address is that Dr. Bashinsky is again urging to this court points which are not before this court, more failure to perfect. Mr. Newman referred to cross points before this court. They're really not. This court did not grant the cross points
for
the
whole case.
But in addition, those were not presented to the Court of Appeals. I believe they are obligated before they bring up cross points to bring those before to the attention of the Court of Appeals. They did not do so by a separate motion for rehearing, nor did they do so in their reply to our motion for rehearing. So I don't believe, unless I misread that part of the court rules, Your Honor, I don't believe that that can be properly presented to this court. In addition, whether the injunction violates the First Amendment, that is not a point of error before this court. Certainly, I believe the last time I looked at it, the law was well established that a constitutional complaint could be raised at any time. However, that has not been raised before this court, and is therefore not a proper point of argument by the respondent. The argument on judicial notice kind of surprised me. That was not in any pleading, I think, to date. That is not before this court, but I don't believe it, unless I missed something, that was before the Court of Appeals. There was no objection at the trial. There was no mention in their response to our motion for rehearing of any objection to the taking of judicial notice. And again, I don't think that is something that can be raised by the respondent at this point. As to the no evidence versus insufficient evidence point, I think I've argued the grammar, I've argued the logic, and I've argued our notice, and I think that the argument boils down to, Mr. Newman cited to Justice Calvert, which we all go running to when we have to try to figure out what the difference between insufficiency and no evidence points are. If they indeed meant to raise a great weight or an insufficiency point, we've known those terms for years and years and years. Why didn't they use those terms? If that was their intent to raise that, why wasn't it brought before the court within those words? Rather than forcing the Court of Appeals and asking this court to put a very strained reading on the point that was, in fact, before the Court of Appeals. To correct something by Mr. Newman, we are not urging that the Court of Appeals should have inferred facts, that there was facts there that could have inferred, allowed the Court of Appeals to infer other facts. That's precisely the problem before this court, is that we think the Court of Appeals did get into the business of reading the facts a little too vigorously. All we are saying is that the facts existed at the trial court level that allowed the trial court properly to infer facts necessary to support its judgment. The last point I would like to respond to is Mr. Newman's assertion regarding the telemarketer's notice of the injunction. That is just irrelevant. I believe the court had pointed out that it was not the duty. I don't believe it's the duty of the state to notify opposing counsel's clients and their employees of the requisites of an injunction. I suspect that it's possible that had we taken it upon ourselves to contact employees and contact opposing counsel, that the opposing parties might have taken it upon themselves to file a grievance against us, because we arguably would have been acting unethically and contacting them behind counsel's back. Granted, the state has had the same attorney. I've had the pleasure of this case for in excess of 3 years. I feel a little bit on the merits of the case, as though the court has told me that I started off a little too quick on a marathon, and I don't just lose, I have to rerun it. So we are scheduled to rerun this case in February. We don't believe that the injunction has now been overturned should affect the validity of the injunction at the time that the defendants were found to have violated it. I was the same attorney throughout. I don't believe it's my duty to do the notice that is required of the defendant's attorney, but I will point out to this court that through the salient portions of the facts here, through the point when the injunction was in fact made available to the employees. The defendants had the same attorney, too, as Bill Maxwell represented Dr. Bashinsky prior to trial, through the trial, and at some time through the giving of the injunction, Mr. Maxwell gave it out, sent it around to the employees, I believe on his own letterhead. In any event, the injunction is binding on the defendants. We did not try a contempt action against Jerry Levine for the telemarketer for the specific reason that she didn't have notice. If she had had notice, we were considering doing a contempt action against her, but she didn't, and she testified that she didn't and that she would have done otherwise. I think that goes to proving up our point that the defendants did not give the facts. They took no steps to make the facts available to both the current patients who were on the drug as well as prospective patients. The trial court was entirely within its rights in assessing penalties. All that the trial court had to find was 5 violations, and if it felt those were severe enough, and given the trial court's recitation of the millions of dollars collected and the need to send a strong message to the defendant, that's all that the trial court needed to sustain its judgment. In essence, then, the however one reads it, anywhere from 106 at a minimum to 200 or more violations of the injunction as can be read from the trial court, those are just findings of fact that were rendered in support of the judge's order, which found specifically that because of what they did and because of the failures to follow the injunction, it was the right thing to do to assess $50,000 penalties against both the Dr. Bashinsky and his alter ego. That finding should stand. Thank you very much.
That concludes the arguments in the second case. Both cases are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. Concludes the business of the court for this morning session, and the bailiff, the marshal, will please adjourn the court.
The audience will please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.